On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The human papillomavirus is the most common sexually transmitted disease. A new study finds that more than a third of American women are infected before they are 24. Some HPV strains lead to cervical cancer, and cervical cancer can kill. But when Texas Governor Rick Perry this month mandated that all Texas middle school girls get a new vaccine against HPV, he hit a buzzsaw. The vaccine's maker, Merck, was a big contributor to Perry. Some saw a payoff. Some saw a license for sexual promiscuity. Some saw government intervention in a family affair. But doctors say it's an important vaccine. Now many states are weighing a mandate. Up next on Point, opportunity and uproar over a big vaccine for American girls. Joining me first today from New York is Arlene Weintraub, Associate Editor for Science and Technology at Business Week magazine. Arlene, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We called you because this is in part an enormous business story. Describe the pharmaceutical interests at play as the country considers this vaccine, Arlene.
Well, yes, this is a very big business story. Merck first introduced the vaccine last year, and it's had very positive pickup. But at the same time, they launched this very aggressive lobbying campaign to try to get the states to mandate it. And, of course, they have a very significant interest in doing this. Wall Street analysts estimate that the drug could ultimately bring in $2 billion a year in revenues for Merck, but that could double if the states mandate it.
So we're talking billions and billions annually?
Yes.
And at the same time, of course, Merck is faced with all these lawsuits over its painkiller Vioxx. We've heard this joke going around, the HPV joke. HPV stands for help pay for Vioxx.
Well, yes, there's one group that opposes their lobbying efforts that has called it that. And you're right, they are very sensitive about their image now because of the backlash over Vioxx, in which they were sort of blamed for aggressively marketing that, maybe for patients who didn't need it.
So far, so good for Merck, though. Their stock up 2.9% before the opening bell just today. But they did announce that after pushing very hard in state legislatures around the country, they've stopped that campaign. Why, Arlene?
Well, actually, they were hearing from some of the oversight bodies, the medical oversight bodies that support the vaccine and, in fact, have recommended that all girls get it. But at the same time, they were telling Merck that, you know, usually with vaccines, there's a very slow mandating process where physicians are given time to have experience with the vaccine. And then, you know, maybe after a certain amount of time, we'll talk about mandating it. And they were being criticized by those groups for being overly aggressive.
Now, there's still a lot going on at the state level. I see here 20 or 30 states contemplating some kind of action. Just yesterday in Georgia, the state legislature, a Senate committee there, clearing a bill that would require Georgia girls to get the HPV vaccine. Of course, this would be probably 11 or 12-year-old girls. Massachusetts, the governor there, Deval Patrick, announcing that his state budget would include money for the vaccine for all girls between ages 9 and 18, though not mandatory. In a lot of other places, Texas is where the really big splash first came. Can you describe what happened there, Arlene?
Well, what happened was that Governor Rick Perry bypassed state legislators and issued an executive order requiring that Gardasil, the vaccine, be administered in schools.
That was February 2nd he did that.
Right, mm-hmm. And this has created a huge controversy. You know, there's some evidence that Merck donated money to his reelection campaign and that a former member of his staff is now lobbying for Merck.
I mean, it's more than evidence, is it? They did contribute it, and his former chief of staff for 2 years is head of the lobbying group in Texas that's carried Merck's torch.
Correct. Now he says that he has looked at the medical evidence and and that's all that this is based on, but of course conservative groups that oppose it are accusing him of being affected by the drug company.
Arlene, do you have a sense, and Merck's only the first, I guess there's another, is it SmithKline Glaxo will be bringing out another HPV vaccine soon.
Right.
Are they surprised at this kind of pushback? I mean, there was a time when vaccines in this country were greeted with a kind of celebration. Think back to polio. Are they surprised to be running into this resistance, skepticism, mistrust?
You know, I think what's going on is a general mistrust of the drug industry, and especially when you think about the fact that there is competition coming from GlaxoSmithKline. Of course, it looks like Merck is looking out for its own bottom line, wanting to get as many girls vaccinated as possible before the competing vaccine comes out. At least that's what the critics are saying.
Mm. At the same time, it's a big killer, and you've got public health people saying this is a good idea.
Correct. In fact, I think a lot of the critics even would agree that this is a good idea. The big question is mandating it.
So there's the business story sort of driving away in the heart of this bigger story. Arlene Weintraub at Business Week magazine, we're grateful to you for bringing it to us.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Let me turn now to Texas, where this really got kicked off and rolling this month in February. We're joined from Houston, Texas, by Dr. Lois Remondetta. She's Associate Professor of Gynecologic Oncology at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. Dr. Remondetta, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Give us your read first on your Republican Governor Rick Perry and why he moved so aggressively to mandate this for all Texas girls.
Well, I think there's been a concern in Texas about trying to eliminate morbidity and mortality by the year 2015, and that may be part of the push. The big concern is that we have a very high incidence of cervical cancer. We have many patients, actually, who even come over from Mexico, immigrants from Mexico, and because of that, we have a very high level of cervical cancer, and many women die in Texas from cervical cancer each year. A vaccine to prevent a cancer is almost unheard of prior to the hepatitis vaccine, and it's ideal for cancer treatment.
Now that Texas state legislature is pushing back, though, saying Governor Perry overreached, as I understand it, they're sort of almost certainly on track to at least try and block this mandate.
I know there is a lot of political controversy, as there have been with many issues regarding sexually transmitted diseases.
Doctor, I wish you'd take us back to a few of the basics here. First of all, you know, what is HPV? What did you make of the report that just came out yesterday saying that more than one-third of American women with human papillomavirus have it by the time they reach 24 years of age? What about the incidence, and how is it related to cervical cancer?
Oh, the incidence is probably much higher than that. That's actually a low number from many of the previous reports. There have been reports that that up to 50% of sexually active American women have already been affected with the HPV virus. Now, just because you get the HPV virus doesn't mean that you'll get cervical cancer. Sometimes the virus clears by itself without any treatment at all, but many times it progresses to a pre-invasive lesion that must be treated surgically with an outpatient procedure. But if left alone, it can progress to cervix cancer. There are actually two versions of HPV that are primarily responsible for causing cervix cancer. We use the number 16 and 18 to describe mm-hmm. them. And there are a few others that are also considered high risk, but the reason that those numbers are important is because those are two of the viruses that the Gardasil vaccine protects against, and the Glaxo vaccine will also protect against.
Now, just to keep it in perspective, I'm reading here, at least you tell me, but that those two strains of HPV that are most likely to cause cervical cancer, those were only found in 2.2% of women surveyed in this new study published yesterday.
You know, actually, I'm not aware of this study from yesterday, but every previous report has suggested that they account for 70% of the cervical cancers.
So the vaccine comes in. If a girl takes it before she's sexually active, it is a very, high percent effectiveness in guarding against these strains of HPV that are most likely to cause the cancer. Is that it?
Yeah, so the Gardasil data actually was done in two populations. Many women were tested, but in the population where it was 100% effective were women prior to exposure to HPV. Now, just because you get exposed doesn't mean you definitely got exposed to 16 and 18. You may have been exposed to 6 and 11, which Gardasil also prevents infection with, and that is responsible for things like genital warts and other dysplasia, early cancers.
Now, presumably, this only works before infection. I mean, once a woman is infected, that's it. The vaccine's won't help.
Correct. Absolutely correct. This is not a treatment vaccine. This is a prevention vaccine, which is why they're indicating using it in 9-year-old girls or girls before. And I think I had some data for you that when testing or surveying American girls, 25% are sexually active by age 15, and that's why it was felt that you needed to really address this long before onset of sexual activity.
Are you recommending this vaccine, or would you recommend it for your patients. I mean, you're an oncologist. Maybe it's too late by the time people come to you. But for a general practitioner, should they be recommending this to young American girls?
I think actually the pediatricians will play a key role in making sure this vaccine gets out. I unfortunately treat many cervical cancer patients. I see young women die of cervical cancer every month.
3,700 per year in this country, mm-hmm. I read.
Yeah, and it's terrible to know that this was preventable. And really, most cases, the reason that people get as far as they do is they haven't had pap smears, which, by the way, just note that vaccine or no vaccine, pap smears have to continue because it really does prevent only the infection of certain HPV types.
So you'd say recommend it, administer it.
I do.
And yet, I think you told one of my producers that you're not getting it for your own daughter yet. Why?
My daughter's 10. Mm-hmm. She is not yet in sixth grade, which is when they're, recommending it. I do believe that I have some time to discuss these issues with her. But if I thought that she was going to become sexually active in the next 2 years, then absolutely.
Are you confident in the safety of this vaccine long term?
Well, safety has been very... all the data has been good in terms of the safety. Mm-hmm. It has 5 years of good data showing that the major side effects are really just vaccine-like side effects where your arm may hurt a little bit. You might have a low-grade fever. There haven't been any other significant problems. What I don't know about the vaccine is long-term effectiveness, and we will learn that over time.
Merck has come strong out of the box promoting this vaccine, and you heard Dr. Lois Remendetta, who's with us from Houston, Texas, talking about how she, as an oncologist, welcomes the push. Let's listen to a little bit of Merck's marketing. Here's part of a television ad by the pharmaceutical company for its vaccine Gardasil. The ads ran as part of a broader campaign to encourage state legislators to mandate the use of the vaccine for young women, girls as young as 9. Here, a series of school-age girls look into the camera and say they don't want to contract cervical cancer.
Ask your doctor about getting vaccinated with the only cervical cancer vaccine. Gardasil.
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 With Gardasil, you could be one less.
G-L-E-S-A. I want to be one less. One less.
One less. And there it goes, the marketing to legislators, ultimately to parents who are thinking about what to do with their daughters. We've been joined by Dr. Lois Remendetta. She's with us from Houston, Texas, Associate Professor of Gynecologic Oncology at the University of Texas there. Right now we're joined from Sacramento, California as well by Edward Hernandez. He's a freshman Democratic State Assemblyman for the 57th District. He is sponsoring a bill to mandate the HPV vaccine for all California schoolgirls starting in 7th grade. Edward Hernandez, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom, and you can just call me Ed.
Okay, Ed, why are you pushing this legislation to mandate this vaccine?
Well, you know, I was listening to your earlier presenter, the doctor, which when you asked her the question about her daughter. Well, my daughter has had the vaccination. As a matter of fact, that's how I originally thought of the idea.
How old is she, Ed?
She's 16, mm-hmm. and we were at the dinner table one evening, and it was about 3 or 4 months ago, and my wife brought this up to me and said she felt it was very important that our youngest daughter have the vaccination. Shortly after that, I went to a City of Hope seminar on health summit, and they had talked about all the statistics and the efficacy rate of the Gardasil and the cancer rates in the state of in the United States mm-hmm. as well as in the world. And shortly after that, I went back to my office and told my staff this is something I felt very strong about, and then we introduced the bill.
Have you been lobbied by the pharmaceutical industry, by Merck?
Absolutely not. As a matter of fact, it was interesting. I did also hear earlier your business perspective with regards to it. I do know the lobbyist for Merck here in Sacramento. I made it very, very clear to him that I did not want to engage with his client. I have a relationship with that lobbyist, but I told him that because of the controversy in Texas, I wanted to make sure that Merck did not come around my office.
And given that it's sensitive, that it goes to fairly young girls here, that its long-term implications are not entirely settled yet. Why the mandate? Why not put out the pros and cons and let families decide for themselves?
Well, if you look back in history, especially the polio vaccine when it first came out, mm-hmm. The efficacy rate of it was not really efficient until the state started to mandate. Once they started to mandate that vaccination, then the polio, as we know it, just stopped existing in our country. And because the science is good, and I did listen to the doctor, and I have been reading up on it, mm-hmm. Here at the end of the day, and a lot of the controversy is about being a sexually transmitted disease, but my argument to them is, and to the critics, is this is about saving women's lives. And so I'm looking at it from a health perspective standpoint.
How are your constituents responding? Are they saying, you go, Ed, or, you know, don't get involved in this in my family, please?
You know, my constituents in my district have not been making a huge uproar about it, and I do agree with, I believe it was a doctor that mentioned about the incidence rates of individuals coming from Mexico. My district is a predominantly Latino community, and I don't know if you knew this, but the particular vaccine or the virus itself causes an increased number of morbidity rate amongst women of color, especially Latina women and black women.
So
that's the population that does not have access to proper health care, for example, pap smears and the ability. And I think this is just one more additional tool to prevent this deadly disease.
You know, that's a very interesting point. Let me turn back to Houston and Dr. Remondetta there. I'm reading here on exactly this point. Worldwide, cervical cancer causes about 235,000 deaths a year, only 17,000 in industrialized countries. In the U.S., 9,700 new cases a year, 3,700 deaths. And here's the interesting number. Among those who die, about 85% of those women have never had a pap smear. So, Dr. Remondetta, is this a drug that's really addressing a public health failure or a health, a health care failure in this country? Would we be better off simply getting, you know, thorough health care for women? I mean, your incidence is highest there in Texas down on your southern border, where perhaps, as in Ed Hernandez's district, there's not enough health care.
Well, certainly we could use improvements in health care, but this is part of it. One of the reasons that mandating the vaccine seems important to me is that many of my patients are uninsured, and without making it a mandatory vaccine, they will have no way of getting this vaccine. And this, a lot of women who should be protected won't be. In addition, as I said, pap smears are going to be continued to be needed regardless of the vaccine. And, we need improvements in healthcare. I don't think that's anything new.
But tell me this. If a woman is getting regular health care and regular pap smears, does she need the vaccine?
Yes.
But if 85% of those who died from it last year never got a pap smear, it kind of suggests just in the numbers to a layman that, you know, the odds are pretty small if you're on top of your health care.
To die from cervical cancer, that's probably true. To eliminate a procedure such as a comb biopsy, outpatient procedures that may affect your fertility, and or hysterectomies before women are finished with childbearing, these are all issues that could be affected by the vaccine.
Dr. Remondetta in Houston and Ed Hernandez in Sacramento, California, I want to begin to bring our listeners in, if I may. Hannah is calling from Savannah, Georgia. Hi, Hannah. You're on the air.
Hi. My comment just has to do with I actually was diagnosed with dysplasia, which is caused by HPV.
Okay.
And I'm of that kind of age bracket of what you would call childbearing age women. And my concern is that it shouldn't be mandated necessarily because we don't really know what's going to happen in the long term. And I don't know anyone who has had any kind of, I was offered an experimental treatment by my doctor. And it seemed to me as a high-risk patient that since I don't know what the long-term outcomes of this would be, that maybe it's something we shouldn't fool with.
You mean the long-term consequences of the vaccine itself?
Having, and in terms of women's fertility and in terms of any other effects that it might have down the road for health.
Hannah, do you know if your HPV is of one of these two strains most likely to cause cervical cancer, 16 or 18? Do you know?
It was, actually, and I actually had to have a surgical procedure to remove a part of my cervix.
Dr. Remondetta, speak to Hannah. She's got it, and she's just leery.
That's interesting. I think that actually have a number of patients who are totally in support of trying to get their family vaccinated, women who have very advanced cervical cancer and have had drastic changes in their life. And actually, many of the women that I've treated that have early precancers, this is really a traumatic experience for most women. It's one of the first times they're exposed to an invasive treatment. There's sometimes, for some women, there's guilt associated with it. And it does have tremendous emotional impact, and so I'm kind of surprised at her response. I think that anything that could prevent an illness that potentially affects the rest of your life would be important.
Well, speak just a little more, if you would, though, to the potential long-term effects of the vaccine. You described the immediate ones as, you know, not really a big deal. But do women need to be afraid, or families, for their daughters that 20 or 30 years from now there could be some kind of unforeseen consequence, or not?
Well, I don't think we've seen that with other vaccines. Certainly, as I said, I would like to have some more years of a follow-up with this vaccine. I would. But the five-year data that we have now is very impressive. 100% efficacy in preventing infections in women who have not been exposed, and really no vaccine-related side effects at this point.
But there's just the rub, isn't it? I mean, I can imagine families, you know, really ready to go ahead. But you're saying it'd be nice to have some more data, and they're thinking, well, if my daughter just is careful sexually, maybe she'll be all right. Why take the risk?
I think the fact that they're even thinking about it and discussing it with their daughters is important. And actually, you bring up a good point about daughters. Also, I'm not sure that we have totally ruled out that this shouldn't be given to both boys and girls.
Would it prevent pickup of HPV in boys, young men?
Yes, but that research is still ongoing.
Huh. So, women first. Let me go to Grace in Needham, Massachusetts. Hi, Grace. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm 22. I have received the vaccine. And when I was at the doctor, I had a really interesting conversation with my healthcare provider about the really narrow range of eligibility. And we were discussing there are women who are in their 40s and 50s who either never married or divorced, widowed, who are on the market again and are getting HPV and getting cervical cancer, and they're not eligible to receive the vaccine. I think it's an interesting thing that people don't really pay attention to as much.
That's stick with us, Grace. Dr. Remendetta, what about that? I mean, it's aimed at young girls because they are not likely to have contracted the virus. But why shouldn't older women who are free of the virus also be able to get it to protect themselves?
Well, I think in terms of a cost ratio benefit, the insurance companies, it's not that they're not eligible, it's that the insurance companies won't cover it.
So they could. They could go out and buy it themselves?
You know, it's my understanding that you can discuss this with your patient and you could possibly go ahead and give it. Certainly after the age of 26, you can get the vaccine. It's just that it may not be as efficacious. And if you look at the Gardasil data, when they used it in general populations who were exposed already, the efficacy of preventing HPV-related illness was dramatically decreased.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of a cost efficacy, it's my understanding that the insurance companies don't want to pay for it, but not that you could not get it if you asked.
But we can see a potential demand there. And Grace, thanks for calling in with that. Let me get a call from Jason in Winthrop, Massachusetts. Hi, Jason. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think both of your guests have touched on this a little bit, but I think that we should talk about the real politics behind this, and the reason that there's so much resistance to this vaccine has nothing to do with the Merck's pharmaceutical company. It has to do with the fact that this is a sexually transmitted disease, and religious conservatives in this country are resistant to anything that says in any way, shape, or form that sex is okay, and they would rather have women die of cancer than send the message to children that it might be okay to have sex where this makes sex safer.
Mm, and so that's where you see the real bump in the road, Jason.
Well, that's where I see the majority of the real resistance to this. I know that we've talked sort of vaguely about conservative groups being against this, and I know that you referenced some conflict of interest with Rick Perry, but the real motivation of these conservative groups is not the conflict of interest. It's the fact that they don't want to see anything that makes sex safer on the market.
Or that, as they might put it, might encourage, in their view, promiscuity. Ed Hernandez in California, are you getting that kind of pushback in your district or from around the state?
It's interesting, and I'm glad that this last presenter or the caller in mentioned that, because I agree. I think a lot of the resistance and the pushback is going to come from the extreme right. But here's my response to that. And my response to the young lady before him, you can have a woman who does everything right, has one sexual encounter the day they get married, and then they can still get the virus. So my response to that and to the extreme right is, this is about saving the women's lives, and it is not about a sexually transmitted disease.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Ed Hernandez in Sacramento, we're very grateful to you for being with us this hour. Thanks a lot for joining us there.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and sign off.
Okay, thanks for being with us. Ed Hernandez, freshman Democratic State Assemblyman for the 57th District, including Baldwin Park there in Sacramento, California. Let me bring in Another lawmaker, if I may, Karen Morgan, joins us from Salt Lake City, Utah. She's a Democratic representative to the Utah State Legislature. She's also vice chair of the group Women in Government. It's a bipartisan, nonprofit group made up of women state legislators around the country. Karen Morgan, thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Your group has been pushing this vaccine. They also, it has also been pointed out that your group has taken money from big pharmaceutical groups. Where's your motivation?
Well, we have a large number of pharmaceutical companies who actually contribute to our organization, as well as a number of foundations, that are not pharmaceuticals. And we have a campaign to eliminate cervical cancer across the country, and that is our goal. It's women should have access, women should have education, they should have awareness about, you know, the risks, the causes of cervical cancer, and how they can prevent it. And that's our motivation.
Rick Perry, governor in Texas, Republican, has pushed it there. How do the politics break down in Utah? Does it have a political tint to it?
Right now I have a bill before the Utah State Legislature for a public awareness campaign to fund that. And actually that bill is going through the process right now. And we're hoping to be able to finish that up actually today. So, and the bill has done very well. We're hoping to get this information out to women across our state about, you know, what they can do to prevent cervical cancer.
Republican-sponsored bill in Georgia. What about in Utah? Is it a partisan issue, or do you see support across party lines?
In Utah, it's a bipartisan issue. I'm a Democrat in the House, sponsored it, got it through the House. I have a Republican sponsor in the Senate. And there's strong support.
So there's another voice of a representative pushing for this, Karen Morgan in Salt Lake City. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Remendetta in Houston, what about pushback from the religious right in Texas? Have you seen it? Is it an issue there?
Well, yeah, my understanding is that has something to do with why Governor Perry's law has not gone through. I actually do also appreciate the previous caller bringing up this point. I do want to mention that there's a very nice article that was published in Obstetrics and Gynecology by Bradley Monk at the University of Irvine, and there's a nice quote in there that regarding some of these concerns, and if you don't mind, it's just very quick. He quoted, "Seatbelts do not cause reckless driving. Tetanus shots do not cause children to seek out rusty nails. And the hepatitis B vaccination has not altered sexual practices or increased injection drug abuse in any population." And I think this is a key point, and this is about saving women's lives. And the fact that we have a vaccine that can prevent cancer is a huge breakthrough.
I understand you're going to be informing two women later today that they have cervical cancer.
Correct.
That must be a tough message to bring.
It sure is, and it's especially hard when the person is of childbearing age and has not yet had children.
Let me go to Marie calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, Marie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to call and explain that this, and I agree with some of the previous callers, that this is not an issue about promiscuity or promoting promiscuity.
Okay.
I'm 46 years old. And I was a virgin when I met my former husband, and then he apparently gave me the virus, and I've had cervical problems for 20-some years now, and including cryosurgery, biopsies. Fortunately, I haven't had any cancerous pap smear results yet, but that's always a possibility, as the doctor on the air explained. I want people to know, this can happen to anyone, whether or not they've had more than one partner. All it takes is one, and so it is a health issue. It's not a sexual promiscuity issue, and people need to focus on that.
20 years of problems. What would you say to a daughter then who was 9 or 10 or 11 or 12 if she had the opportunity to have the vaccine? You had the opportunity to get it for her, Marie.
Well, I would definitely get it. I've got a 14-year-old son, and I don't know if this would work for boys to prevent from passing on?
Not yet. Not yet approved for that, Dr. Remendetta has told us, but it sounds like you're ready.
Oh, yeah, I would be ready for any daughter that I, you know, and obviously I don't have a daughter, but I would certainly advise that for any daughter. and friends' daughters, too.
Mm. Marie, we appreciate your sharing your story. It's very illuminating. Thanks for calling in from Des Moines.
All right. Thank you.
Let me turn to Chicago now, if I may, and Dr. Lewis Cooper. He's Professor Emeritus of Pediatrics at Columbia University. He's a member of the Steering Committee for the National Network for Immunization Information, past president of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Cooper, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. I've enjoyed very much the comments of the previous speakers and the callers, because they really did describe how important this issue is and how important it is for us to see that all young American women receive this vaccine, which is a great breakthrough.
I wish you'd give us the long view here on Americans and their attitude toward vaccines, because it's clearly changing here. Or there's some new elements that have come into it. Before you do that, if Dr. Cooper and Dr. Armendetta, I want to listen to just a little bit here from an ad for polio, or it's a 1957 Universal Studios newsreel, actually, lightheartedly depicting small children in Kansas receiving polio vaccines. Let's listen.
Citizens of Protection Kansas are really getting protection. The tots are the first to face the sock vaccine needle. This miss isn't quite sure about the whole thing, but, well, it really wasn't so bad. Next.
Next, they say, and it's all chipper, the tots facing the sock vaccine needle. And you can hear the kind of, let's go, country, let's do it. Dr. Cooper, what's changed?
We're victims of our own success, Tom. The reality is that not only don't America's young parents remember most of these diseases, polio, measles, mumps, rubella, and so forth, or meningitis, but that more than half of the pediatricians in this country are so young that they've not treated these diseases. What that does is that allows any concern about the safety of vaccine to be blown out of proportion, and there are an increasing number of people who are worried about, quote, all the side effects of vaccine. Mm-hmm. Given the amount of misinformation on the internet, given the love of the media for controversy and for giving airtime and space to all kinds of unsubstantiated allegations, it's no wonder that our pediatricians spend more time now every day explaining to young parents why the vaccines are important than we did when I first started, where the parents just lined up and said, yes, let us have that vaccine, doctor.
But has the pharmaceutical industry brought some of this on itself with some of its highly publicized drug failures, with its big money lobbying for these drugs? I mean, was that the way vaccines came on the market decades ago, on the back of big money lobbying campaigns?
Absolutely not. They came on the market as miracle preventions for communities that were scared to death of polio, and rightfully so, and measles and congenital rubella and pertussis, whooping cough. That's changed now because we've done such a good job of preventing those diseases with vaccines. The other issue is that we now have an environment of tremendous skepticism about all institutions, about government and what they say, about even the church and allegations with regard to priest behavior, and even such institutions as the one you represent, the media, the trouble the New York Times has had. So it's no wonder that the public is concerned about what's said, and certainly the episodes with certain drugs, like Vioxx, as you mentioned, have raised heightened awareness, increased skepticism, and it really increased the job that we have in protecting what is the most important tool we have in preventing disease by vaccine. That's public trust.
Then let me just ask you, Dr. Cooper. We heard from Dr. Remendetta, and now we've got you as well. You're past president of the American Academy of Pediatrics. I can imagine a lot of families wanting to do the right thing here, but not wanting to put daughters at risk. So do you see significant safety issues with this vaccine or not? If you had a daughter in this age group, would you give her this vaccine now?
I have three granddaughters in this age group. Mm-hmm. And you can be sure that they will receive the vaccine. this looks like a good vaccine. The comments made about mandating it really have helped. If there's any good news, it's that the controversy over the mandates and all of the allegations on what I really consider to be side issues, namely increasing promiscuity for which there's just no data, the role of Merck and undue influence in legislators, that may make interesting news, but what's important is that it is causing people to pay attention to the fact that cervical cancer is a bad disease and that wide use of this vaccine will prevent this disease. And that's the important message.
Let me take a call from Burlington, Vermont. Lori, you're on the air, Lori.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
This is Lori LaPlante from Greater Burlington area.
Great to have you.
Excuse me?
Great to have you, Lori. What do you see?
Well, I'm a special education teacher, and I'm the parent of a 14-year-old daughter who's actually going today for her second injection in the series of the Gardasil vaccine.
It's a three-injection course, right?
Three injections, spaced apart strategically.
And you're doing it. You've done it.
Oh, yes. We've started it. And the way I feel about it is I had spent a lot of time reading about it and listening about it on various talk shows, and I believe that for years, we've been calling for a miracle of some kind of vaccine to cancer. My understanding is there's not a lot of cancers that are precipitated by viral conditions. And so now we have a vaccine that can prevent a certain kind of cancer, and it's something we've wanted forever. I had a parent die of cancer. I've had friends die of cancer.
What did you say to your 14-year-old daughter about it, Lori? How did you explain it to her?
We discussed it, and I discussed the reasons for it as she gets older and has to confront those sexual issues. She's not sexually active now.
Mm-hmm.
And I just promoted it as this is an opportunity for you to stay healthy. It's part of your long-term health care, the same reason we got vaccines for you when you were young.
Were you candid about the sexual part, the transmission piece of it, or did you just sort of blanket it in it's against cancer?
Yes, because our discussions around sexual activity are ongoing. You know, it's been on a need-to-know basis as she's young. Now she's in high school. There's a little more pointed discussion. Her school district teaches, you know, health issues very explicitly and directly. So I feel like the whole topic for a teenager needs to be an ongoing developmental discussion as they get older.
And you're right in the middle of it, and we appreciate that firsthand account. Lori, thank you very much for calling. Let me get another call right here from Wellesley, Massachusetts. Oren, you're on the air.
How you doing, Tom?
We're all right.
I have no problem with the creation of or the education of such a vaccine, but I do have a major problem with the mandating of it. It seems like it takes away the right of choice that so many of us are for in this country, for someone to do what they want with their own bodies and to discuss it amongst their family and to decide that way. But the mandating of it seems to me, I don't know, a taking away of that right.
Let us look at that. So yes to the vaccine, no to the mandate. Dr. Cooper in Chicago, what do you say to Oren?
I say I understand and agree with his concern about mandates. That's why, in fact, we've had to explain why we mandate for whooping cough, pertussis, measles, polio, and so forth. We made the case to the public that it was so in the public interest that we get everybody immunized, and we showed that absent the rules like no shots, no school, we could not get immunization levels up high enough not only to protect the individual vaccinated, but the fact is that with these other diseases, if you don't vaccinate everybody, you put at risk those children who can't be vaccinated for some medical reason or religious reason, or who are taking a drug which prevents the vaccine from being infected. And by immunizing everybody, you protect those few people who otherwise would be at risk of vaccine. But you need public support for mandating, and that only comes out of public understanding and is one of the reasons that most of the medical groups and public health groups in this country have said it's perhaps premature to have to mandate this vaccine at this time. Let's assure the public of the reasons for the vaccine. Dr. Ramadi and I see two different ends of the telescope, and were I in her profession, I would understand and desire mandates as soon as possible. But as somebody who works on all vaccines, as someone who's seeing the pushback from people who are opposed to mandates because of rights of privacy and so forth, or concern about adverse events with vaccine, we think it's important to give the public a chance. And there are criteria that I think many of us are now using before we look at the issue of a mandate, including the effectiveness of the vaccine, the amount of disease it causes, and is it possible to implement this vaccine? And all of those things take a little bit of time.
And as you say, public understanding, maybe first among those, we're working on that right here, right now.
We've seen serious problems when public trust and public understanding declined. For example, the outbreaks of measles in Great Britain, where there were allegations that measles, mumps, rubella vaccine caused autism. And most disastrously, the resurgence of polio across a huge chunk of the world, because in Nigeria, there were those who alleged that polio vaccine created sterility. Hmm. So public trust is critical.
Well, we're working on airing it right here today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let me take a call from Somerville, Massachusetts, and Karen. Hi, Karen. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
I am a 40-year-old woman infected with the HPV virus who has two young children, a son and a daughter, and I would love for both of them to be vaccinated. One concern that I have is whether or not they have been exposed through vaginal birth,
mm-hmm.
whether or not this vaccine will be effective for them.
Because you've got HPV, you have had the kids. Dr. Remendetta, what do you say to Karen?
That's a very low risk of transmission. Certainly, as we know, if you've been exposed to one of the viral types that the vaccine prevents exposure to, then the vaccine doesn't work. The vaccine, as we've said before, is not a treatment. So if a person has been exposed, then it is not treatment. But although we're not totally 100% sure how one gets the virus, it seems to be sexually transmitted and not through vaginal births. And there are, as we said, so many women infected with HPV virus, and the risk of getting the HPV virus before you're sexually active is extremely low, to zero. Usually, even before having one partner, the risk is zero. And that's why we're trying to encourage women to get it, or girls to get it, in the ages of 9 to 13.
Mm. So, Karen, there's some reassurance for the kids anyway, and we thank you for your call. Dr. Cooper, what about the cost of this, $360?
I'm so glad you brought it up. And
the most expensive vaccine in history.
Yes, and I'm glad you had two legislators on, and delighted with the Utah issue of public awareness.
Mm-hmm.
What Ed Hernandez, I wish he was still on, it's important that the California legislature and legislatures everywhere do what they can to assure that there are no financial barriers to this vaccine. And that's particularly a problem for the young women who are not eligible for the Vaccine for Children program in this country, and for undocumented and other people who may not be able to pay for the vaccine. So the best thing the legislators can do in the 50 states, because it varies from state to state, is look to see that there are no financial barriers to the vaccine.
And that's what's being proposed in Massachusetts right now by the governor here. Not a mandate, but they'll pay if families can't. Wow, a lot of insight in this hour on what's become a kind of controversial issue, but you really lay the facts of the case out for us. Dr. Remendetta, your last word to families considering this for their own daughters listening today.
Just that this is a huge opportunity. The vaccine appears to prevent infection from the two most serious types of HPV. And just one point, even having one partner can increase your risk of being HPV infected by 10%. So as the woman said earlier, it's not about promiscuity. It's about preventing a cancer in women.
There is the word from the front lines. Dr. Lois Remendetta, professor of gynecologic oncology, University of Texas, thank you very much for your time and insights today.
You're welcome. Thank you, Tom.
And Dr. Lewis Cooper in Chicago, thanks very much for the long view, Dr. Cooper. Really, really great having you.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.